Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar for 2024, August 16th, and I.B. John Pasmino. Our session today relates to two interesting celestial events involving the Moon in September. So the title of the session is Moon in September 2024. The first event is on September 17th and 18th, depending on your time zone, is a very shallow partial eclipse of the Moon. And on the 22nd of September, pretty much all over North and South America at night, or at worst in twilight, is an occultation by the Moon of many stars in the Pleiades astrosystem, or the Seven Sisters. You may want, before playing this session, to go to the AV Files page, and I'll show you how to do that in a sec, and pick out the lessons on occultations and on the last lunar eclipse in 2023. Okay, so now make sure you have both the audio file, which you're listening to, that's the MP3 file. You do need the PPT file for the slideshows. If you lack that, go to www.nyskies.org. On the home page near the top is audio video files. Punch it. Now in this file page, scroll down to the bottom, skip the text part, and you enter the links for all of our seminars. So go down to the bottom and you'll see two files, PPT and MP3, with title Moon in September 2024. So download the PPT file, spot it to slide number one, and then come back here and resume. Okay? Slide one is the answer to our quiz from last session about Jupiter. And I asked why an ordinary Latin and Italian Spanish word, satellite, as you pronounce it in English, ever was applied to mean a moon. Well, actually a lot of you got this right, because when you consider in the early days of the telescope, the planet Jupiter was the only other body in the solar system that had little stars hugging and staying with the planet as the planet continued its motion through the zodiac. So the little stars were like attendants or companions. And Jupiter, being the king of the gods, should have lots of companions. And that broke the mystery, because if you look up in a Italian dictionary, English Italian, or Spanish Italian for the word satellite, you get the concept that we have here. This is from a Latin dictionary, satellus in the singular, or satellites in the plural. And you see the definitions there: a companion, a follower, an accoutrement, a bodyguard, that is, a person who stays with and hangs around as an aide or an adjutant to someone else as, well, a politician today. When he goes from to make a speech, he doesn't go by himself, or he goes with a lot of his aides, and a lot of his agents. So Jupiter, as the king of the planets, the king of the gods, as he goes through the cosmos, he would have with him a stable of up to four attendants, or satellites. And I think when Huygens discovered Titan as the moon of Saturn, he treated it as a aide-de-camp, if you will, of Saturn, and simply applied the same word, satellite. Well, again, using the English. And from then on, every new moon, even of other planets, Mars, Uranus, and Neptune, were also called satellites. And then, of course, you have the artificial satellites around the Earth from the 1950s and 60s, and then space probes which are sent to become satellites of other planets. And I also included in slide one the close-up of Jupiter as seen by Craigie, the artist who drew pictures of what the planets look like in small telescopes. You see Jupiter there with the belts, and the pink thing at the top is the great red spot, and three followers, satellites. Okay, so now we're on slide two, the title slide, and the text simply says that if by chance you happen to have the slides and you're looking at all the pretty pictures, so what? Well, it tells you to go to the AV files page and pull down the MP3 and hear the narration. Having one file without the other gives you a half-baked, almost nonsensical presentation. And you have some extra reading. And the first one, ECL-FAC, Eclipse Fact, which is background material for solar and lunar eclipses. See, when I started doing the website, and when an eclipse came along, I would throw in a lot of boilerplate background material, and then after a while I said, no, this is just silly. Apart from adding a lot of typing and being repetitive, I stripped all that from the next eclipse and put it into a separate file, added a bunch of more stuff. So the notices of eclipses in our web, or the mainly through the NICE events, is basically just for the eclipse, and the extra material is in this permanent ECL fact file. The next, OCC-FERQ, occultation frequency, which is pretty important, and you should carefully read that, because I'm sure if you watch occultations, you will recognize that, hey, you know, I remember seeing a lot of occultations of Aldebaran, but a couple of years ago, they seemed to have petered out. Or, ooh, I see a lot of occultations of Spica. I didn't notice them before. And so that article explained why and how the moon switches between occulting a star and then missing it and coming back to occult it again, and has several examples that you can follow. And the last one, PLEI-OCC, Pleiades Occultations, is a discourse on the last time we ended occultations of the Pleiades. That is, the Pleiades occultations petered out, and we entered a new round, was then petered out, and now we have the current round, which is restarting. And it also has some background about the Pleiades themselves. Incidentally, Pleiades is a plural noun. The Pleiades are such and such. The Pleiades were such and such. Not the Pleiades is or the Pleiades was. Okay, just remember that. So we now hop on to slide 3. In 3, then also in 4 and 5 as follow, I have a slice of the autumn and winter sky. You see in the lower left corner is Orion. I didn't label anything on here to reduce the clutter, but if you're familiar with the stars, that's Orion. And if you follow the belt stars to the upper right, you come to the V-shaped figure of the Hyades, with the bright star being Aldebaran. Then you hop across the ecliptic, and you see a little knot of stars, which are the seven sisters, or the Pleiades. The diagonal line running through is the ecliptic, the center line of the Milky Way, or the actual path of the Sun through the zodiac. In the lower right is the position of the Moon. At the time of the lunar eclipse on September 18th. That's down there among the fall stars. In scene 4, the Moon moved, especially one day, the 19th of September. It is almost on the ecliptic, that is, if you recall the previous slide, the Moon was rather south of the ecliptic, and it is riding upward, or northward, and is crossing from south to north, and will be on the north side of the ecliptic in slide 5. But you notice that the crossing, which is called the node, N-O-D-Delta-E, and because we're heading northward, it's called the ascending, or a little more commonly nowadays, the north node. The Moon reaches the Pleiades on the 22nd of September, noted in slide 5. The Moon is well north of the ecliptic, and far enough so that it actually can intercept Pleiades stars and cause occultation. We'll see a little later on that the Moon doesn't always do this. Some years the Moon is not far enough north and it misses the Pleiades, or indeed can be on the south side of the ecliptic and actually far enough so that it hit the Hyades and Aldebaran. But in these next couple of years, the Moon will be intercepting the Pleiades, and if you look through your list of upcoming occultations, there are none for the Hyades or for Aldebaran itself. So those are the two big events. The reason I included the node is to show how the distance of the Moon from the node in degrees influences the kind of lunar eclipse we actually will have. In this case, the moon just barely nicks the umbra, and if the moon were maybe a half a degree farther away from the node, we would have no partial eclipse at all. So this is the eclipse that we're experiencing in a couple of weeks. It's about the limiting case for a partial eclipse of the moon. I'm not going to give a full treatment of lunar eclipses like I do when there's a total lunar eclipse, and not even for a large or deep partial. So this will just be a quickie refresher. In 6, we have the Earth, and the Sun is over your left shoulder, off to the back someplace, and is lighting the forward side of the Earth. And you see part of the night side, and out in space in the background is the shadow of the Earth. Now, we will not actually see the shadow, and indeed, occasionally, especially when there are more attuned to space flights than we are today, and there's a greater enthusiasm, including actual spacefaring clubs, someone asked me, you know, if I were in orbit, could I see the umbra and penumbra for a lunar eclipse, and then watch the moon when the eclipse is coming along, actually enter the umbra and the penumbra? Well, you can't. You have to wait until something enters the shadow, that is, blocks the sunlight, and the shadow of the Earth will fall onto the moon as a screen. So the inner part is, this is just then a diagram, a little out of scale, illustrating the concept of the Earth's shadow. The inner zone with the moon in it is the umbra, and the outer donut around it, the ring around it, is the penumbra. Now, it's a little difficult for beginners to understand why this actually happens, but it's easy to see that it can happen. If you stand under a street light, even some of the newer ones have very tiny bulbs, the shadow on the ground of you and everything else is not sharp edge, but has a diffuse border, like a transition zone. You have the dense inner part, that's the umbra, and you have the lighted area of the ground around it, and the transition zone is your penumbra. And of course, we see this also in sunlight. Your shadow on the ground from the sun has this diffuse border, which darkness shifts from being dense at the inner edge against the umbra out to full daylight at the outer edge. So that's the concept of penumbra and umbra. On occasion, the moon, as she goes around the Earth, when it would be a normal full moon, instead the moon dips into the shadow and we get the eclipse. Typically 2 or 3 full moons in the year, which are 12, will suffer an eclipse, partial or total. Why don't we get eclipses every full moon? The short answer is in figure 7, which shows in the Earth in the middle, and the solid circle is the apparent orbit of the Sun around the Earth, the path in the sky being the ecliptic. It comes as a little surprise to some people that it is easier to, for eclipse computations, to let the Sun orbit the Earth. And that way you have a fixed point, the Earth, and the both moving bodies, the Sun and the Moon, interact together to form the eclipses. The dashed circle, this being a perspective view, I mean, orbits of the planets and the Moon are ellipses, as you see here, but this is not the orbit ellipse, the orbits being substantially circular, but are seen at a tilt. It's as if you built a model of the Earth, Sun, and the Moon in a baseball field, and you're viewing it from the stands. Now, if you play baseball and you follow the sport, you know that the four bases are in a square, 27 meters on a side. But when you view them from the stands at a slant, it looks like a diamond. And this is why we often speak of the baseball diamond, while in actuality it is a square. So the same situation here. The dashed circle is the orbit of the Moon. The inclination or the tilt is greatly exaggerated. It's actually about 5.2 degrees. You notice that on the right-hand side, the orbit is north of the ecliptic, north being up toward the top, and on the left-hand side, the orbit is south of the ecliptic. The crossings at both top of the picture and the bottom are the nodes. The lower one, where the Moon coming around the front, traveling left to right, is heading northward and crosses the ecliptic, heading north. That is the ascending or north node, and it is symbolized conventionally by a very stylized, almost uretic type of symbol for a dragon. Many of us use the Greek letter omega for a little easier to draw. The other one at the top of the picture, which would be toward the back, is the descending or south node, where the Moon in her orbit crosses the equator to enter the southern half. And there the symbol is upside down, and that is the south node. Also included in the both at the bottom is the symbol of a dragon, and at the top the dragon is upside down. I don't know where the story came from, but a common thought was during an eclipse, the Moon is eaten up by something, and during the Sun eclipse, the Sun is gobbled up by something, and conventionally it's some sort of a sky monster and a convenient Earth equivalent is the dragon. So the two points where the nodes are in the orbit are often called Draconic months. That is the adjective form of dragon. And the upside down omega is the descending node, and the right side up one is the ascending node. Let us imagine that the Moon were new and was on the left hand side on the orbit a bit south of where the Sun is. you get a normal new moon because you're looking toward the sun in daylight, and you're looking at the night, dark, side of the moon. But the sun is unaffected. The moon misses it. So you would not get an eclipse of the sun. If you imagine diametrically opposite, the moon would be at the northern side of her orbit, and it would be full. But it would not be in line with the shadow, which has to cross the ecliptic. That is, the line from the sun to the earth hits the ecliptic at the opposite side of the sky, which is the center line of the eclipse cone cast by the earth. So we're north of the ecliptic, and you get an ordinary full moon with no eclipse. See, so we end up with a few varieties of lunar eclipse, and these are shown in slide 8. In the right panel, we have the moon at roughly 1 hour intervals passing through the umbra, and assuming north is up, the moon is passing from west, which is the right, to east, on the left, and is in time lapse passing through the umbra, and for a period it is actually completely inside. Normally it would be obscured because there's no sunlight on it, but for the diagram the author wanted to emphasize that the moon is in fact there. So that is your total lunar eclipse. In the center pattern, the moon's orbit is such that the moon cannot get completely into the umbra, but only partially in it, and in this case, the northern part of the moon does get covered, the rest remaining in the clear. This is your partial eclipse. The moon could also have passed on the north side of the shadow, in which case the south part could have been covered. It would just be a symmetrically opposite form of a partial eclipse. The left side shows that the moon's orbit carries the orb too far from the umbra, and it misses completely. Actually, in this particular view, it's marginally kissing the umbra, and this is the moon is only always in the penumbra to make a penumbra eclipse. Astronomers typically disregard penumbra eclipses because the shading on the moon typically is so slight that unless you actually knew there was an eclipse in progress, you would not notice it in your goings about on the night of the full moon. Our eclipse in September is close to penumbral in that the moon is a wee bit north a bit, so that the extreme northern edge does dip into the umbra. So the moon is far enough from the node, almost to the limit, where it becomes only a penumbral eclipse. A schedule or timeline for the eclipse is given in slide 9, and I never knew the actual source of these images, but apparently whoever does this is pretty careful when there's an eclipse to make a diagram like this. He does it for solar and lunar eclipses, and sometimes other websites simply paste them into their pages. But what we have, we see the two circles for the umbra and penumbra. They are calculated in size appropriate to the distance of the moon away from the Earth. The ratio of the umbra-penumbra does vary a bit, well, actually radically, because of distance between the Earth and the spot where the moon it would be. So that's not a standard diameter. And I'll show you later, toward the end of the segment about eclipses, there's a form that you can get from the NASA website, which gives you all the peculiarities of the umbra sizes, the speed of the moon, distance from the node, and all this and all that, so that if you'd like to plot a diagram like this, you could do so. Okay, starting in the lower right, we have that the moon touches the edge of the outer edge of the penumbra. Nothing physically is visible in the sky at this moment. So it's a geometrical event rather than an observational one. And the times are in universal time, UT, which is, for all intents and purposes, synonymous with GMT, Greenwich Mean Time. That is, the definition of Greenwich Mean Time vanished when we switched to atomic time, but the phrase has such an iconic and historical value that we let it be a synonym for universal time. So you have to change all of these for your longitude or time zone. So nothing really happens at the very beginning geometrically of the eclipse. The next three phases are overlapping because they come pretty quickly. We have the beginning of the partial phase, when the moon first touches the umbra, and the center disk, when the umbra is greatest penetrated onto the moon, or the distance between the moon and the center of the umbra being the least. And then the left-hand disk is when the moon finally leaves the umbra. So the whole span with the umbra on the moon, or the duration of the entire eclipse, the visible part of the eclipse, is quite 1 hour. And the moon moves off toward the left, where it eventually leaves the penumbra and becomes its normal full moon self. So that's the timetable. If you're doing any public viewing of this eclipse, even if it's just for your neighbors in your yard, you may want to snap this picture and then print it large and then post it on a wall or a garage door or something, so that they can read and see about where they are. See, so this would be a short, shallow penetration eclipse. Bear in mind, we can't just pick and choose an eclipse and say, okay, we'll finagle things up and go have an eclipse. Whatever one nature gives us, that be the one we look at. In 10, I cranked up a astrology program and cut a horoscope for the date of the lunar eclipse. I set the time for 0 hours, this is in New York time, just so that the moon would be in high sky. Okay, east and west refer to the horizon, which would be the center line horizontal through the diagram. Material below that line is hidden. The earth didn't rise, it already set. above is what's in your sky. So the ecliptic, which is what the circle is, rises in the eastern sky over there in the east. You see the signs of the zodiac, and then they march across, and then we have the last one, which is setting, where it says west. And the one which is on your meridian is up there around the 1 o'clock position, where it says south. MC, just above it, refers to Medium Salem, the middle heaven, or Medium Celi, middle of the heaven. Either one is correct. Something mid-heaven, the idea of mid-heaven in the sky is where the ecliptic crosses your local north-south line that divides the sky into east and west. So I label the sun down near the bottom, because that's where it is near midnight. And there's the moon labeled. And to the left of the moon is the ascending node. The moon is near the node, and the inner ring of angles is a angulator which can be rotated on the computer screen, and I put the zero at the node, so you can see where the moon is. We're about 11 and 12 degrees to the west of the node. It's essentially one day's run away from the node. By the way, although I labeled the symbols, the actual place around the zodiac is given two ways. One is a small superscript number. It gives you the degree within the sign it sits. So you look on the outside, you see Taurus, and then you have the little numbers representing the degree 0 to 29 within Taurus. And the other way is to simply note the angle around from, say, the sun. And you notice that the sun is almost opposite the moon, 180 degrees away. You take the angular position of the moon and add 180 to it, and that would be the distance from the sun. Now, September's full moon is commonly, at least in North America, called the harvest moon, in the sense that in the early colonial and settlement era, you had to plant in the spring and hope for things to grow during the summer, and by the time the fall comes, your crops are fully matured and they're ready to be cut down, prepared for meals, and stored for the coming winter. In those days, of course, we did all such work by natural light. But it turns out that in the fall, the full moon and large moon, 2 and 3 days on either side, rise more quickly each night than when they do in other months. And the same thing happens to the full moon in October. So the harvest moon is so called because it is in your sky for a longer period sooner after sunset to give you some additional artificial light. Well, artificial in the sense of besides the sun, you now have the input from the moon. The October full moon is the next on the series, and that's the hunter's moon, where the animals who have gorged themselves and lived around all during the summer and coming into the fall are in the condition to be hunted, and they too can be stored away for the winter. Now, conventionally, the full moon nearest the autumn equinox, September 21st, is the harvest moon. So it is possible to have a harvest moon at the beginning of October, 10 days after the equinox, which would still be the nearest one because the previous would be back in August sometime, too far away. On the rare occasion where the equinox is exactly between 15 degrees after one full moon and 15 days before the next one in October, then the one in September is the harvest moon. And we can see that very clearly by the proximity of the moon to, well, by the date in the corner up there to the autumn equinox, even though it is full. At the bottom, near the sun, is a little symbol. It looks kind of like a Pac-Man sitting on a bench, and is labeled apogee. This particular program only marks the apogee of the moon's orbit. Other astrology programs would give you the perigee also. But if the apogee is the farthest point, the perigee is simply reflected across the angulator 180 degrees, and it lands it pretty much near the ascending node and the moon. So when the moon is full and close, say within a day, of the perigee, we have a super moon. It has no astronomical significance at all. However, it will be hyped up in the news media. Oh, we're having this fabulous eclipse of the moon, and it's also a super moon, and it's also the harvest moon. Well, there's nothing in the sky to show that it's a harvest moon. That's a calendar situation. Unless you've examined the moon, especially telescopically, you know, routinely, you would not notice that it's any bigger or brighter. It'll be in high sky anyway, so it's going to be big and bright. And the eclipse would be a very lousy, shallow, partial eclipse. Just keep those in mind when you listen to the news reports, and if you're game to it and a talk show host mentions the harvest eclipse and super moon, you can call in and note that the New York Sky's astronomy seminar clarified this all for us. Now, a lunar eclipse is visible everywhere in the world where the moon is in the sky, which necessarily would have to be the night side of the Earth plus the dawn and dusk zones. So in figure 11, we have a map showing the world. It's one of those flat equatorial maps of the world. And the center zone, which is dark, covering the Americas, is the zone where the eclipse will be visible. The white zone at the far left and over on the right is daytime and there is no eclipse. The shaded areas between them are the zones where the eclipse occurs near moon set. That is, the eclipse starts, the umbra is on the moon, and then the moon sets. Or when the moon is rising, the moon rises, the umbra is already on the moon, and we watch the eclipse end. This is different from a solar eclipse where the total phase or the annular phase can only be seen from a narrow strip across the ground, and everybody else sees various degrees of partial. The only difference in the aspect of the eclipse because of your location and time is the altitude and azimuth in the sky, what direction to look for the moon, and how high off the ground do we look up. Not that finding a full moon would be all that difficult for most people, but pedantically, astronomers would like to know what is the altitude and azimuth of the body in question, time by time in a schedule. The timetable for the lunar eclipse for New York, and it's actually valid for anywhere in the New York skies region, which is substantially 100 kilometers radius around Herald Square on Manhattan, with a little bit of gerrymandering. We include all of Long Island, we stop at the Delaware River, that kind of thing. So the left-hand column gives Eastern Daylight Savings Time when each event takes place. And we start at moonrise and we continue on all the way to, at the bottom, moonset. The second column there, which gives the events, one says first contact and the other says fourth contact. The detailed explanation is in that article, Eclipse Facts. But to make a quick story, if you continue to take two disks and bring them together, when they first touch externally, that's first contact. And if one disk is smaller than the other, you can continue moving them. And at one point, the smaller disk will just fit inside the big one, internally tangent, that's second contact. If you can continue the motion, the inner disk will then touch the outer disk again, that's third contact, and then continuing on, fourth contact, when the two disks separate. Since the moon never is entirely inside the umbra for this eclipse, there is no second or third contact. The moon touches the umbra and then leaves it. So that's why you have first and fourth contact. And I make the note about crossing midnight, and you'll be amazed, even experienced observers, we goof this all up. So they look in the article, the eclipse is on the 18th of September, and so on the 18th of September in the evening, they go outside, and yeah, the moon looks damn big and round, it's only a day after full. And they wait and they wait and they wait and they wait, and they think, shouldn't there be any darkening? None at all? And then they go back inside, look at the email, and you have reports of everybody who got their pictures or reports of the eclipse that occurred last night, 24 hours ago. So please do mind when you shift between time zones, if the shift is a crossing of midnight, you must also bump up or back the date. I note there for the first event, moonrise and then moonset, selenohelion question mark. Selenohelion strictly is seeing the lunar eclipse in progress. The sun is in the sky. Of course, this would occur near moonset, but after sunrise, or just after moonrise, but before the sun set. And we had a few of these in New York over the last, 10 years or whatever. But a softer Selenhelion is to see the moon as close as practical to being full. No, not a day older or a day younger. No, that's no good. You want a moon which is maybe a few hours from being full. And it will rise a few minutes before sunset, and therefore you will see the rising moon while the sun is shining on foreground features in your landscape. And at the end of the eclipse, well, certainly the moon is about as close as you're going to get to full during the night of the eclipse, so you have the possibility of seeing a Selenhelion before the eclipse and then after the eclipse. They are sensitive to your longitude, because as you change longitude, before the moon moves so damn fast, you could have the time of moonrise, too late, the sun set already, then the moon came up. So it is a longitude sensitive event. That's why I put the question mark. A simulation of what the eclipse would look like near mid-eclipse is in 13, and you notice that just the northern part of the moon has umbra on it. However, the penumbra could be at its own inner edge, that is, which would be bordering the umbra, dark enough to show as a brownish or orangish smoky tint. Indeed, during a regular total eclipse, as the umbra is approaching the moon before first contact, we would notice, usually anyway, the smoky appearance at the point of first contact, that is where the umbra will intercept and hit the moon. So that gives us warning that we should be looking out for that first contact. And then at the end of the eclipse, fourth contact, as the moon is leaving the umbra left, but you still have the residual shading of the penumbra, and when that finally quits the moon, we can declare the eclipse observationally completed. So we may see a false extra penetration, which may fool people to think that the umbra actually had a greater penetration than what geometrically was calculated or shown here. Just be aware of that. 14 and 15 are the top and bottom half. If I showed the entire sheet on one slide, you couldn't read any of the numbers, so I enlarged and then just split to show the top half, and then there's an overlap in 15 to show the lower half of NASA's eclipse fact sheet. And to improve legibility, I did a negative print, so you have white lettering on a dark background. The original is, like most printed material, black on a white background. This is the moon. You see, this is the dark, the brilliant white disk is the umbra, and the moon, on the second we have underneath on 15, you see the moon skirting through it. And the figures in the corners of both sheets give you parameters by which you can geometrically roll your own. This does require knowledge of geometry, and it really, really helps if you have drawing tubes, you know, parallel bars, triangles, angulators, compasses, and the circle makers, things like that. And so that's what you would need, and maybe a good solid drawing board so you can tack down a worksheet and play around with it. But I put that in for eclipses because there are people among us who like to do this sort of stuff. If you hop on to 16, this just illustrates what is the Selenoheliion. And I just happened by chance to pick the one after the eclipse. And again, this is peculiar for New York. You may have an easier view of it elsewhere, or you may just find that the geometry doesn't work out. So it's a wide angle view of the sky near sunrise, and over on the left of the big sweeping arc, that's the horizon, you see the compass points around it, and on the east of the rising sun. The sun is above the horizon, and over on the right hand side is the moon close to setting. So there will be a time where I can be watching the moon approach the horizon, and the foreground would normally be dark because the sun didn't rise yet. But then, as the sun comes up, the foreground will get sunlight, but the moon will still be there, and a few minutes later it does in fact set. So that's a soft or weak or light Selenoheliion, and it occurs for a given location several times a year. Normally, a Selenoheliion of this type makes sense only for the appearance at sunset. I use sunrise here because of the eclipse. You're out there alive for the eclipse anyway. But normally, you anticipate the coming of the full moon. So the sky is daylight, and there's sunlight on your foreground, and here come the moon. The moon is rising, and there's still light from the sun, and then finally that fades away, but you did get the moon and the sun together. Now, you do need a clear horizon in both directions from the sunset through you to the moon rise. Now, you can anticipate the moon rise by your shadow on the ground due to the low sun points to where the moon will come up. Within a couple of degrees one way or the other. I've known many people got things all crisscrossed, and they're looking in one direction along the eastern horizon, and they don't see the moon, they don't see the moon, they don't see the moon, and their buddy Tahe, it's over here. So after the eclipse, such as this one, then we can relax for a few days and look forward to the occultation of the Pleiades. Now, this one here in September is the return, the first of the occultation in the new series for New York. But I mentioned before, those in latitudes south of the city have been seeing occultations for roughly a year. It's just that the zone where the moon was covering the Pleiades was creeping northward, and it is only now, well, in a month, will hit the Pleiades for the city area. And then on, the occultations will occur consistent with the Pleiades being in the sky at night, or in the daytime where you can't see it anyway. So there is the moon approaching the Pleiades on the north side of the ecliptic. So yeah, I just duplicated the slide from earlier. The relative size of the Pleiades and the moon shown in figure 18 for some totally other event. So the moon will never cover completely the main stars, not even the big seven of the seven sisters, but it will cut a swath through them, and some will remain in view all the time while others suffer the occultation. So when we say the Pleiades are occulted, there is a leeway where the moon can travel and it will hit one or more, but never all at once, the Pleiades stars. Dissertation data about the Pleiades is in 19. You get the size, the distance, the actual celestial coordinates, and things like that. The brightest star in the group was given by Bayer the Greek letter Eta, but he did not give Greek letters to the other stars in the group. When Flamsteed came along and gave his numerical designations, he sweeped across the Pleiades and the rest of Taurus, and you have their numbers in the high tens into the mid 20s in the Flamsteed designations. And he overlied the Bayer designation, so the Eta also has a Flamsteed number, and many of them in historical times were given proper names. So a map of the, with a photograph labeled with the proper names of the Pleiades stars and also their Flamsteed and Bayer designation, we see that in slide 20. This is for references. You see, a program that calculates occultations may use the Bayer designation, or it may use the Flamsteed designation, or it may use some other catalog, such as the zodiacal catalog, Zulu Charlie catalog. But the most common naming, or when you refer to stars in the Pleiades, is to use the proper name, just like they use the proper names to cite stars in the constellations. Recall that the Pleiades, on and off over the ages, was a constellation for itself, and at other times was merely an asterism, and like now it's an asterism within the constellation of Taurus. It's also, and the previous slide mentioned it, of all the star clusters in the sky, the Pleiades is the one that's the most obvious star cluster aggregation. The others, although they may be a little larger, having more stars, you have to know that this is a cluster, not just a bunch of stars sitting near each other in the line of sight. See, the Pleiades have also been, in the home astronomy world, a object of totally bogus and facetious controversy. It's also called in Messier's catalog, M45. And a lot of people, unfortunately it is a lot, insist that we no longer call the Pleiades by their Messier number, because Messier had no role whatsoever in discovering it or elaborating on it or determining certain properties of it. It had been known since antiquity, and he had his nerve to put it in his catalog and call it M45. And so some purists, if you call it that, simply refused to ever call the Pleiades M45. But don't you worry too much about that. So what actually will happen on September 22nd, well, if you look at slide 21, we see, this is for some previous event, you have the moon over there, and there's a band across the Pleiades, which is the diameter of the moon. The moon moves west to east across the sky, that is through the zodiac, and therefore what's on the right behind the moon, or trailing the moon, are stars which already were covered by and revealed again by the moon. And on the left or eastern side of its path are the stars which will, over the next hour or so, be covered up. And there are stars to the north and to the south which in this go-around of an occultation are not at all covered. So this emphasizes the moon is too small to cover the whole Pleiades, but as long as it gets in away from the edge, you will get several good hits, all easily seen in telescope. It is actually best to use a telescope. I know some people like binoculars, which are perfectly fine, but here's where a telescope does much better. And a low power, one that shows the entire moon in the field of view, and this way you get to appreciate the moon's motion. The way you observe this is ahead of the moon on the Pleiades, with the clock drive running, assuming that the scope is all polar aligned. And then, as the moon creeps eastward against the diurnal motion of the stars, you will see it come into the field of view and eat up the stars one by one, and then disgorge them from the trailing edge. The entire passage may take about 2 to 3 hours, depending on the exact path through it. So it is a leisurely event, good for club activity or as an adjunct to public viewing. I will note that this should be, and the ones later, pretty much immune against ordinary haze, but if you get smoke from the Canada fires or Horace from local fires, and of course obviously it's cloudy or rainy, then you lose the event. But if it's just a little hazy, as long as you can see the brighter Pleiades and then of course the moon herself. Now the previous picture showed the corridor of the moon passing through the Pleiades, not just for a particular date, that is a particular pass over the Pleiades, but also for a location, in this case New York City. The reason for specifying the location is the moon is so close to the Earth that its spot on the sky will shift according to your location on the ground. This is very important for occultation in general, and certainly for eclipses of the sun. That's why when you calculate a occultation, you have to specify the observer's location, maybe a pick list of cities or towns, or by keying in a lat longitude. So if you look at 22, this shows what I mean. Here's the moon as drawn to illustrate the path of Mars behind the moon. There was an occultation several years ago as viewed from various cities in the United States. The track of Mars behind the moon is shifted north or south, north being up, according to the lat long of the observer's location. So some observers, like the path near the south edge of the moon, will have a short occultation, as well as those near the northern leg, or the orientated, but the ones in the center where the planet went behind the moon center over center will get a much longer duration. So to simply say in a national news broadcast that the moon's going to cover the Pleiades on September 22nd, go out and look at it. Well, within the United States, this happens to be true because there's enough slop in the location of the Pleiades stars, so if you miss seeing certain stars, certain others will be hit, and the audience will then get some kind of a show. But if you're doing this generically with listeners in Quebec and Canada or down in Mexico, they may be disillusioned because the moon passes north of the Pleiades or south of the Pleiades and they do not get the occultations. So that's why occultation calculations must, in their printout or other presentation, give the date, the hour, the time zone, very important, the time zone, which may not be the time zone of the observer's location. Typically, they're calculated in universal time for that observer's location, and it's the observer's business to worry about daylight time or standard time, and whether he's near enough to the standard meridian for the longitude offset correction. But that illustrates that you would get different paths behind the moon for the same target, in this case Mars, depending on where within the eclipse zone you actually are seeing this occultation. So in 23 is the calculation for several of the Pleiades stars for New York in this September go-around. The number of stars that the program, this is using occult, A-C-C-U-L-T, the very standard workhorse among us astronomers. So in any case, you can set, among other things, the magnitude of the dimmest star you want the computations made. Now, for a limited range of dates, but basically during that one day of the Pleiades occultations, I could set it to, say, 6th magnitude, 7th magnitude, and I get a list of 30 events. But I normally defaulted the program to anything brighter than 4.0 and let it go with that, in which case three or four of the brightest stars in the Pleiades are captured and the dimmer ones are not. So this is an incomplete but representative set of stars in the Pleiades for being occulted. The detailed column headings are at the bottom. Essentially, each event has two rows. The upper row gives what goes on when the star disappears. The column P is right after the date and the hour. The letter D for delta means disappearance. And in the second row for the same star, the R means reappearance. And like I said, the other columns you can look at underneath at the bottom. But the last three give you a hint where around the moon's disk would you see the star touch to enter or break free to leave the moon. The first one gets a little fiddly where it says minus something or other, and I would leave that out. For one thing, the phase of the moon is such that there are no real good cusps. That number, which is the cusp angle, measures where, counting from the north cusp, where the star appear or reappear, disappear. So we'll skip that because there is no cusps. The next figure in degrees is angle around the edge of the moon counterclockwise from celestial north. So if you have a polar mounted or equatorial mounted telescope, that might be what would be best for you. The last one in the row is the counterclockwise angle counting from the zenith straight up, which would be good for a azimuth telescope, and so on. Again, these are valid within the New York Sky's territory, but I do advise is you're going to start viewing maybe a half hour beforehand. So if the occultation occurs a second or two early or late, because you're not exactly at the fiducial point within Manhattan, I wouldn't sweat it. Now, it just turns out that although this is the first of the Pleiades occultation in this new series, occurs for us just about when dawn is breaking, and then it continues through twilight and into daylight. So observationally, this may not be the best time to look for it if you're just a casual observer. So 24 shows the view, simulating the course, for New York. We're looking kind of west, and you see the skies are gray blue, and even the Hyades are kind of dim, and the moon is just approaching the Pleiades. And then thereafter, the sky brightens and brightens and brightens, and the moon is well into the Pleiades at sunrise. However, our good folk farther west, so in 25, on the west coast, the simulation for the same moment on the east coast, we have that the moon passed the Pleiades, that is, the occultation is complete, but you still have a darker sky, and the Hyades showed pretty nicely also. So that's a longitude effect. So while we on the east coast get the poorest observing condition, from the central and out to the coast, you get a good view. But the others in the series, and at the end of the session, the slide 30-31 kind of thing, then we will see the predictions for the November and January 2025 for us in the city, which are in full regular nighttime. But why did the occultation of the Pleiades shut off and then return in waves or seasons? The great detail of that is in the two articles, Occultation Frequency and Pleiades Occultation, back on the title slide. See, but here in slide 26, we'll take a look at this a little more closely. We have here a slice of sky, happens to be in the vicinity of the Pleiades. The ecliptic is in the center. I don't think it's actually marked. Okay, it doesn't matter. But you know where the ecliptic, you've seen it on previous pictures, enough of that. Okay, so the solid line on the north side of the ecliptic is the farthest north that the moon can excurge as she goes through her orbit, and the solid line south would be the southern limit. Depending on where the node of the moon is, the moon could be anywhere north-south within that corridor. Now, so far I kind of assumed that the node was fixed, but if you go to any of the lessons on eclipses, you know that the nodes of the moon orbit regress. They migrate backwards through the zodiac signs, and taking roughly 18 years to complete a cycle. So in doing so, even though the moon will pass the Pleiades essentially every sidereal period of the moon, it will do so each month at a slightly different distance from the previous node, the ascending node, which was the previous one, until eventually the node is so far away in angle that descending node is really the nearer and is approaching the Pleiades. So then the moon's orbit swerves away from the Pleiades, and the conjunctions miss the Pleiades, and we get no occultations of those stars. So the corridor within which stars could be occulted by the moon, which for practical purposes is of 6 degrees north and south of the ecliptic. That would include not just the inclination of the orbit, but also the parallax between the north and south poles of the Earth. And that would constitute your quiz, okay? But that is what the story is so far. 27, 28, and 29 give the moon's position when it is passing by the Pleiades at the extreme south part of its moon orbit. That is when its latitude is the farthest south, or as some people say, when it's at the southern solstice of its orbit, if you consider the nodes, sorry, like analogous to equinoxes. So 27 shows when it's farthest south, and it is nowhere near the Pleiades, but you can get occultations of the Hyades and Aldebaran. And this would occur for several months until the node moves downrange, or actually uprange, and pulls the other node uprange toward you. In 28, we have the moon passing by the Pleiades, but it is on or near its node. So the moon will skim past, you get a nice conjunction, beautiful photo op, Hyades, moon, Pleiades, but no occultation of the Pleiades stars. And during the years when the moon node is in this vicinity, there's a drought of Hyades or Pleiades occultations. 29 shows the moon near its northern solstice point, that is where the orbit is such that the extreme northern parts of it are next to the Pleiades, and we're getting then occultations of the Pleiades each time the moon passes by. A point to note, just for curiosity's sake, is the Pleiades and Hyades occultations alternate with a dead period in between, that's slide 28. So we can never get both within the same year, Pleiades occultations and also Hyades. That's the concept of the seasons that Achfreek article emphasizes, and which is detailed for the Pleiades in play.ach, also back on the time the title slide. That just that's something to because many people don't realize what a large swing, roughly 10 degrees for our position here in New York, that the moon can have, and therefore it modulates what stars we can expect to occult and which ones we'll have to pass on for a few more years. 30 and the last slide, 31, give the occultation predictions again for New York for the next round after September, which is in November, and the next after that, which happens to be in January of 2025. And the information for each is the same, it's just that we captured the star Maya as well as the other three. So enjoy yourself, depending on your longitude, for the September Pleiades occultations. It will be a little difficult to photograph. I tell you, it is extremely difficult to get a photograph of the moon with the Pleiades in chemophotography. Either the moon comes out beautiful and you can hardly see the stars, or if you expose long enough to see the stars, the moon is hopelessly overwashed. In fact, if there's earth shine, the earth shine may be so bright that it looks like a full moon. Digital imaging does a lot better because you can do interesting maskings and contrast effects in the digital darkroom, so that you can bring out the stars while leaving the moon more or less as it appeared to the eye at the telescope. And this is what a little frustrating for us in the early years, say before roughly 2010, 2007, when virtually all of us home astronomers were still doing chemophotography. And the transition to digital started about then, was well underway by 2010, and was essentially complete by 2012. So that concludes what we're talking about. The two major activities of the moon in September, and now for our quiz. If you go back to slide 26, where I show the highway, if you will, along the ecliptic, parallel to the ecliptic, where the moon can swerve, depending on how the orbit is lined up, and thereby cover stars within the zodiac. So what I'd like you to do for your quiz is, with your planetarium program, scan, say, plus 6 to minus 6 degrees north and south of the ecliptic. Now, if your planetarium program allows you to align the sky according to the ecliptic rather than the equator, and then you can put a lot long grid, this would make life a hell of a lot easier. Otherwise, you may have to do it, say, using a paper strip with degree marks on it and slide it along the ecliptic in regular equatorial mode. So what is the assignment? To name all stars brighter than 3.0. That is everything down to 2.9 magnitude that can be covered by the moon. Not all of them could be covered from your location. If you're pretty far north, then the far northern stars may never be covered from your latitude because the moon by parallax will be shoved to artificially south of where the geocentric position would put it. And conversely, if you're real far south, then the far southern stars would never be covered. So just stick with the bright stars along the ecliptic, which ones can be covered by the moon. And so, until next time, pray for clear skies.